KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, with a proposal on the November ballot to legalize the recreational use of marijuana, Californians are asking more questions about the health effects of the drug. Is it addictive? How does it affect the brain, the lungs? As part of Forum's 2016 election coverage, we talk with doctors and researchers about whether cannabis is safe enough to be legal. Join us after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Proposition 64 on this November's ballot will ask Californians to make recreational use of marijuana legal for adults 21 and over. It would also allow adults to grow small amounts at home for personal use. The proposal for legalization is sparking questions about what we know and don't know about the health effects of the drug on our minds and bodies. Research has lagged in the U.S., which classifies marijuana as a Schedule I drug, making it harder to get federal approval to study its effects. Still, there is some information out there, and in this hour forum, we'll take a closer look at it and hear from a panel of experts on how safe they think recreational use of marijuana really is. Joining me are Paul Armentano, Deputy Director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Good morning, Paul Armentano.
Thank you, Mina. It's good to be here. I'm sorry I can't be in your studio.
We're sorry, too, but we're so glad you're able to join us by phone. We're also joined by Stanton Glantz. He's a professor of medicine in the Division of Cardiology at in the Department of Medicine at UCSF's School of Medicine. Good morning, Stanton Glantz.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
And we're also joined by Larry Bedard, a retired emergency physician. He's also director of the Marin Healthcare District Board and the former president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. Good morning, Larry Bedard.
Good morning. Or aloha.
Aloha. Oh, you're joining us from Hawaii. That's right. And we're also joined by Bertha Madras. She is professor of psychobiology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And while we're on the subject, Bertha Madras, where are you joining us from?
I'm joining you from Belmont, Massachusetts, the home of McLean Hospital.
Well, we have gotten across the continent for this show. Bertha Madras, I'd like to start with you. And if I could, let's start with the brain. You know, there have been some interesting studies that have come out recently, but one that's frequently cited is a New Zealand study that suggested marijuana use could lower IQ. Can you talk about that study's results and sort of new studies that have come out challenging those results?
I certainly would like to discuss it. Just before I begin, again, I would like to add that the initial comment that because it's scheduled makes it difficult to study. There are over 22,000 studies on marijuana and cannabinoids in the literature, probably more study than almost any other drug in science. So to say that it's impossible to study because of regulations, I think, is probably a difficult point to make.
Well, are you talking about studies globally, or are you talking about studies specifically in the U.S.?
Well, both, because, you know, the vast array of studies have been generated in the U.S.
Right.
On recreational marijuana, on cannabinoid chemistry, biology, and so on and so forth. 22,000 studies, the vast majority have been conducted in the U.S., in fact.
But is the classification, hasn't it made it harder for folks? They have specific regulations around what kind of marijuana plants can be tested on. Has created some obstacles, I imagine.
It's made it harder for clinical trials. It's made it harder for clinical trials for human studies. It certainly has not interfered with the 22,000 manuscripts that have been generated. So let's get on to the IQ study. So Madeline Meyer, the Dunedin study, which was reported in 2012, showed that there is a loss of 8 points of IQ in children. This is a longitudinal study, children who began using marijuana before the age of 18 and continued to use until the age of 38. The loss of IQ persisted if not at 8 points, but was prevalent regardless of how much use continued after the age of 18. So prior to the age of 18, the developing adolescent brain is clearly more vulnerable to the adverse effects of marijuana. More recently, a study came out by Jackson et al. In the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, which was the same journal that published the Meyer study. And he used two cohorts, one from California and one from a different state. And what he claimed in his conclusions is that in twin studies, there seemed to be no differences in IQ between the early initiators versus the later initiators. He himself presents his own caveats, which I think have to be differentiated from the Meyer study. The most important caveat is that the two cohorts that he looked at went only until the age of 19 to 20, whereas the Meyer study looked at a longitudinal course which began at pre-adolescence and went all the way to 38. I think that's very important because these brain changes may take quite a long time to show up.
Mm.
The second limitation in his study was that there wasn't a really good analysis of how much marijuana was used over the period of time. The Myers study periodically at age, you know, early on, prior to use, age 18 in the 20s, there were periodic assessments, whereas this study just began at one time point, ended at another time point. There was no analysis of how much marijuana had been used in the interval. And so one had to rely on the recall of the individuals over perhaps a period of 9 to 10 years.
And just to give our listeners a better sense of what you're talking about here, basically it could compare the IQ of twins at age 9 to 12 before either had smoked marijuana, and then it tested them again 7 to 10 years later after one of them had started, to try to control for this idea that maybe there was an IQ drop among people in the New Zealand study because the people who initially started smoking marijuana had, you know, different socioeconomic factors that were affecting their lives over the course of that time. And so you've pointed out that you feel like his two caveats of the fact that it is unclear how much one twin smoked over another, and also that it wasn't, you know, a decades-long study yet. I'd like, though, to get...
Oh, and there's another point, and that is Meyer did reanalyze the data with regard to socioeconomic status and other confounds, and she found that that was not the variable that was important with regard to the IQ differentiation.
I see. Well, let me give Paul Armentano a chance to respond, because I know, Paul, that you and your organization have, you know, been talking a lot about this twin study and feeling like it's a good study.
Sure. Well, let me just begin by saying I'm sure no one on this panel, and certainly nobody at Normal, is going to advocate that it is a good idea for adolescents to use marijuana. And that's one of the reasons we argue in favor of regulations and adult use only restrictions. As far as marijuana's effect on IQ or cognition, as Ms. Madras said, there are actually over 24,000 papers in the literature specific to cannabis. And there are many papers specific to this question of marijuana and potential impact on IQ. And outside of the one paper by Madeline Meyer in the Dunedin cohort, you are not going to find other papers replicating those results. Peter Fried's work in Canada, his longitudinal studies looking at marijuana and IQ, did not find IQ differences. As noted, the UCLA recent twin study, which is a larger longitudinal cohort than in New Zealand, did not find those differences. A longitudinal study in the United Kingdom that was recently published also did not identify those sort of differences. And there were many caveats in the Dunedin study. In fact, the very same paper that published that study some months later, published a critique of that study, arguing that, in fact, it was socioeconomic variables that made the difference. And Madeline Meyer's own work has argued that there is no way to identify whether marijuana is, in fact, an independent variable because the majority of people that used marijuana also used alcohol and tobacco.
Okay, but you did say something interesting at the outset, which is that nobody believes that adolescent use of marijuana is a good idea. And I just want to stay with this question for a second in terms of why it isn't a good idea for young people to smoke Stanton Glantz. What does the research tell us that we know about people who start young?
Well, I can answer that question about tobacco and nicotine easily because that's what I do. The work we've done on the health effects of marijuana has actually been looking at cardiovascular effects. But to the extent that there are some common pathways for the effects on the brain of nicotine, which is the drug in cigarettes and cannabinoids in marijuana, and there is some overlap. There are also some important differences. But the fact is the brain is still developing up until about age 26, and in particular the parts of the brain associated with rational behavior. And exposing developing brains to these chemicals changes the way the brain develops. And it may not just be if you look at the effects of tobacco, it's also many of the other products that are in the cigarette smoke. And when you look at marijuana smoke and tobacco smoke, they're not all that different from each other. So even though the psychoactive agent is different, you're still getting a lot of strong oxidizing agents. You're getting a lot of ultrafine particles that trigger inflammatory processes. And, you know, there's a reasonable chance that in addition to the nicotine in cigarettes, these other elements are affecting neurological development too. So, you know, I do think, as you heard from the first speaker, these changes take place over a long time. As I said, your brain isn't fully matured till you're about 26. So a study that stops at 19, we've published papers on tobacco saying that's way too early to stop looking. But I can talk about the cardiovascular.
Yeah, and
effects.
I would like to talk about the cardiovascular quickly. But I guess what I'm generally hearing, Dr. Larry Bedard, is it true then that if you don't start young and don't use marijuana that often, that there is not that much evidence out there of any permanent harm to the brain?
I believe that's what the research shows. I think Dr. Glantz is right that, you know, the human brain doesn't completely mature until you're 25. If we knew that when we had alcohol, the drinking age probably would be 25, not 21. So, and I think there's universal agreement among the panelists and the advocates for Proposition 64 is this whole thing is based on it's going to be safer for our children if AUMA passes. Right now, it's been easier for the last 20 years in Marin County for adolescents to get marijuana than they've been able to get alcohol. So AUMA recognizes potential adverse effects from marijuana and does, I think, a great job of controlling that by, you know, making it 21 by the packaging requirements, by the product safety requirements. So once again, we all agree adolescents shouldn't use it. Much like alcohol, I think that's culturally set the age at 21, and that's what Proposition 64 does.
Stanton Glantz.
I came down to mostly talk about biology, but we've done a very detailed look at Prop 64 from a public health perspective. And while Prop 64 gives lip service to preventing youth use, when you get down into the details of it, it actually puts in place a set of regulatory rules and priorities that are probably going to end up having the effect of promoting marijuana use. It really prioritizes the business of selling marijuana over public health. And the most straightforward reason for that is if you compare the so-called prevention activities that are written into Prop 64, they really look like the tobacco companies and the alcohol companies' phony youth smoking and drinking prevention programs. They don't look like the California Tobacco Control Program. The Department of Public Health, which knows how to prevent use of tobacco, and that's information that could easily be transferred over to marijuana, is basically cut out of the entire process. And
but you know, even with the age restriction of 21, you're saying would not...
Well, the age restriction is better than nothing, but the one key lesson we've learned in the 20-some years of the California Tobacco Control Program is you can't really separate kids from adults. The reason that we have the lowest youth smoking rate in the country is because we have the second lowest youth, or pardon me, the second lowest adult smoking rate. And the only way to keep kids from smoking is to have adults cutting their use. And I everything I've read about the behavioral aspects of marijuana use points to exactly the same thing. So the idea that you can somehow build a wall between 20, teenagers and adults in terms of prevention of use of these psychoactive substances is just... There's a huge empirical base to show that's not true.
Bertha Madras, what do we know about adolescent use and how it changed in states where it was legalized, like Colorado or Washington?
Colorado has the highest use rates in the country relative to all the other states. And also Washington State is coming up very quickly. Use rates go up depending on normalization, medicalization, and legalization. With regard to 18 to 25-year-olds, the use rates went up from 2006 to 2014, 16% on the national average. In Colorado, they went up 36%. So there's no question there is a doubling to tripling of use rates regardless of what you regulate, because you cannot regulate it away from kids. A recent study in Colorado showed that 25% of young people aged 12 to 17 who get marijuana get it from their parents.
Bertha,
so if you legalize for adults, you're going to get a transfer to children.
And Bertha Madras is professor of psychobiology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. We're also talking with Paul Armentano, deputy director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, Larry Bedard, a retired emergency physician and director of the Marin Healthcare District Board, and Stanton Glantz, professor of medicine in the Division of Cardiology at UCSF School of Medicine. So speaking of cardiology, Stanton Glantz, let's move on to the lungs for a bit here. Talk about the effects on the lungs, and also this question about secondhand smoke exposure as well.
Right. Well, as I said earlier, if you just look at the chemistry of marijuana smoke, it's not terribly different from cigarette smoke, and for that matter, wood smoke or diesel exhaust. You get a huge amount of ultrafine particles, a lot of strong oxidizing agents, carcinogens, industrial solvents, and these are taken into your lungs. The particles are so small, they're a 50th to 100th the size of a human hair. They go right through your lungs, into your blood, and into cells, and those chemicals and the particles trigger all kinds of bad biological effects. They cause problems in your lung, asthma. The work that we've done has been studying the effects on your blood vessels. And a few minutes of marijuana secondhand smoke basically turns off the ability of your blood vessels to adjust to changes in the need to get blood flow. And the interesting thing is that the effect is essentially identical to secondhand tobacco smoke, but the difference is when you stop the exposure, the functioning of your arteries is compromised for two or three times longer after you stop the exposure to marijuana smoke than cigarette smoke. And the interesting thing, we tried it on THC-free marijuana cigarettes and got exactly the same results. So it's not the nicotine or THC which are causing these vascular effects. It's something else. And those are very important because those changes can trigger a heart attack. And over a long period of time, the biological changes that happen are linked to development of atherosclerosis
so
and heart disease.
Marijuana causes heart disease. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that we can say that marijuana causes biological changes that have been linked to heart disease. Not to be too like academic about it. There's a little bit of research out there showing a link between marijuana use and heart disease, but the problem in assessing all of those epidemiological studies, as one of the earlier people said, is most of the people who use marijuana also smoke cigarettes. And it's very hard to pry, in terms of long-term human epidemiology, the effects of the tobacco versus the effects of the marijuana apart. But the beauty of the experimental work that we've done at UCSF is there we are controlling the exposure, and the change, the short-term changes we see on effects in blood vessels, those changes have been linked to both triggering heart attacks and also the long-term development of heart disease.
Well, Paul Armentano, let me let you get back in here. I'm sure you have a response to Stanton Glantz.
I'd like to comment on a number of things that were said. One, Dr. Glantz is referring to a study in rats, not in humans. In fact, UCSF in 2008 published the results of a longitudinal 15-year study that looked at 3,600 adults that were participants in the Cardia Project that did smoke marijuana, and they did not find adverse cardiovascular effects in that particular study. The Dunedin cohort that was talked about earlier, a 20-year longitudinal study, also looked at cardiovascular risk factors. It did not report significant cardiovascular risk factors in humans. In fact, there's also a Harvard study from 2013 over an 18-year period that did not find increased mortality in heart attack survivors who used marijuana post-heart attack versus individuals who did not. So we actually have human longitudinal data assessing cardiovascular risks. So those should not be overemphasized based on a single rat preclinical study. I'd also like to comment on Ms. Madras's statement about youth use. We have dozens of studies that have assessed youth use marijuana patterns in the last decade during a time period where more than half the jurisdictions in the United States have amended their marijuana laws. And consistently, those results find that changes in marijuana laws are not linked to upticks in youth use. In fact, the CDC came out with a report within the last month that found that youth rates of marijuana use have not increased since 2002, and in fact, the percentage of young people saying that they have access to marijuana, that it's easy to obtain, fell by 13% during this period of time. It also fell among those age 18 to 25. But Colorado has always had one of the highest levels of marijuana use in the United States. Their level of use has not changed post-legalization.
Well, let me quickly let Bertha Madras get in here just before the break. Bertha Madras, you just have 30 seconds.
Yes, Paul is misquoting statistics. I'm quoting the National Federal Database, the National Institute, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. He's misquoting that. He's misquoting the IQ studies, and he's misquoting the cardiac studies. Unfortunately, one can cherry-pick data in order to present advocacy for marijuana, and that's precisely what he's doing in this situation.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join the conversation. The number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. We're talking about the health effects of marijuana and whether the drug is safe enough to legalize. Call us with your questions, your comments. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org or post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Proposition 64 on this November's ballot will ask Californians to make recreational use of marijuana legal for adults 21 and over. And this proposal for legalization is sparking questions about what we know and don't know about the health effects of the drug on our minds and bodies, and then the bigger question of whether or not it's safe enough to be legalized. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Ben asks, how do the effects of marijuana compare to those of alcohol or cigarettes? I ask because both of these substances are recreational, as marijuana would become if legalized. And I think this is the bigger question, Larry Bedard. I mean, we know that cigarettes and alcohol have adverse health effects when used in particular ways. And as a physician, do you think marijuana has adverse health effects to the degree that it should not be legalized?
Oh, absolutely not. I think if you look at the drugs that are recreational drugs, including alcohol, nicotine, etc., by far, marijuana is the less harmful or safer drug. And I think as an intelligent adult, it ought to be a choice and not a crime. Recently, they did a study in England where they quantified what is the adverse effect of drugs, both as an individual or on society. And alcohol was number one as the most destructive drug used in England. Marijuana didn't rank in the top five, barely ranked in the top 10. So it is much safer than alcohol, and I think every emergency physician I know, if we had a magic bullet where we could give a shot or something and convert alcoholics into marijuana users, we would do it with every alcoholic we saw.
Stan Glantz, you are on record saying that you support legalization, but you feel like it needs to be strongly monitored. You know, there needs to be a lot more in terms of oversight.
Right. Yeah, I think the one place I could agree with the Prop 64 advocates is I think the war on drugs has been a disaster and it hasn't worked. The problem is not with the idea of legalization, but the way that Prop 64 does it. Because, you know, it's true that if you look at the overall public health impact of marijuana today, it's less than alcohol and tobacco. But the market has been suppressed by the fact that it's illegal. Once it's legalized, especially in the very pro-business regulatory framework that's written into Prop 64, then you're going to see the market corporatized, and we're going to see mass marketing. We're going to see aggressive product engineering, as we've seen with cigarettes, which over the years have made them more addictive and more dangerous. And so I would expect that the adverse public health impact is going to grow. And so to me, and what I personally think is that, yes, we should stop throwing people in jail for using marijuana. But concurrently with legalization, we should put in place a large-scale demand reduction program modeled on the California Tobacco Control Program. I mean, I think the great irony here is that tobacco is perfectly legal, yet it's become socially unacceptable and use is falling and nobody's being thrown in jail. Marijuana right now is illegal. It's socially sanctioned, and use of marijuana, especially among young people, is actually higher than among tobacco. And so the right way to legalize, in my view, is basically to take what we've learned from tobacco and apply it to marijuana before, concurrently with legalization, before you've had the development of a rich, powerful, aggressive industry. And in fact, if you look at alcohol, if you talk to the people who study alcohol, you know, the person who has an occasional glass of wine isn't the problem. The problem is the people who are responding to the very, very aggressive marketing, especially marketing directed at kids, by the alcohol industry. And there's nothing in 64 that would prevent that.
But you're saying the health effects in and of itself can be managed. Bertha Madras, do
you
believe that?
Well, the way to manage the health effects is to minimize use. So it should be legal, but nobody wants it.
Got it. Bertha Madras, do you agree?
No, I don't. I don't think that marijuana should be legalized. I think the comparison between alcohol and tobacco is problematic because different drugs have different effects. The primary effect of marijuana is on the brain. And from my point of view, we have never waged a war on drugs using that vernacular. It is essentially a defense of the brain that I am waging, that I think a number of people who are scientists, who are cognitive of the data and the outcomes are waging.
A listener writes, we must not legalize this drug. Why not hearken to studies done in New Zealand and Duke University? They proved the danger that marijuana inflicts on the developing neocortex. effects. Tony writes, cannabis can trigger schizophrenia in those who are disposed to developing that illness due to other factors. There's an NPR story and several studies on this. And I believe, James, in San Francisco, you have a question along these lines?
Yes. My brother started smoking in his teens. He was an excellent student, an outstanding student. But he told me and he told others that he started hearing voices in his early 20s when he smoked marijuana. He had to go through shock treatment. He was treated for schizophrenia all of his life. He had early onset dementia in his 60s, and he passed away last year at the age of 71. Also, I was trying the Bates method for eye exercises, and when I tried it, after smoking marijuana, my eyes were jumping up and down, and I could not control my vision as I normally did. And so I'm wondering if there have been studies about the increase of, the onset of hearing voices after smoking marijuana, and if there have been any studies about the effects on the eyes of marijuana. I don't even try it anymore because of the effect on my eyes.
James, thanks. Bertha Madras?
Yes, that's a very easy one to answer. Bechtold, this just a month ago, published in the American Journal of Psychiatry a longitudinal study in adolescent weekly users, and they showed, as a function of how many years they used between 1 and more than 4 years, they had increased bizarre thoughts, increased paranoia, increased hallucinations, increased subclinical psychosis. Marijuana lowers the age in which schizophrenia appears in people. And the causality between marijuana and schizophrenia, the evidence for that is increasing rapidly yearly with new data. There is a very strong association. Acute marijuana can induce psychosis in people who otherwise are normal, healthy, and have no evidence of the disease. Eye tracking, which this gentleman has complained about, being unable to eye track properly is a symptom of schizophrenia. So there is a strong and growing evidence that there is an association and probably to some extent causality because of dose response between the use of marijuana and schizophrenia. People who are psychotic do much worse if they smoke marijuana. They have much higher relapse rates. They have longer relapses, more frequently relapses, and are hospitalized at much higher rates.
What?
There is believed to be between an 8 and 24% attribution of schizophrenia to the use of heavy, high-dose marijuana in the population.
What do we mean when we say use? Heavy use or?
Heavy use.
So we know much more about heavy use, and how is heavy use defined?
Heavy use would be defined as daily or near daily use and more frequently than daily use. And that is where the associations become very powerful. The same is true with amotivation. If you've used more than 400 times before the age of 18, you're much less likely to graduate college, much more likely to be unemployed, much more likely to be on welfare. 3 longitudinal studies have shown that.
How much is known about the effects of using marijuana once a week or a couple times a month?
Infrequent use, the associations between that and problems is far less robust than it is with heavy use. There's no question about it. There are 2 factors, how frequently you use and how strong the THC is.
And I guess that's why folks are divided on whether or not it should be legalized at this point, because, Stanton Glantz, you want to weigh in?
The reason that I think it should be legal is because I think throwing people in jail for using it has failed. But I think what we've learned from tobacco is you can have a substance which is legal, but if you have an aggressive demand reduction program and an effective regulatory environment, you can get it so most people won't use it. And, you know, this point about intermittent use versus heavy use is very, very important because the commercial market that Prop 64 creates with its very pro-business regulatory structure is going to bring in corporations who are going to want to maximize profits. And how do you do that? By promoting heavy use. I mean, if you look at the alcohol problem, again, the people who occasionally have a glass of wine aren't the problem. The problem is the people who are targeted by heavy alcohol marketing and promotion.
Well, let me get some more listeners in here. Lorenzo in Oakland. Hi, Lorenzo.
Hi. Yeah, I think that my guess is that almost all of the studies are about smoking cannabis, and I'm wondering if there are any longitudinal studies on edibles, which probably, smoking any kind of vegetable matter, whether it's tobacco or cannabis, is harmful to the body. So more of a comment than a question.
Well, thanks, Lorenzo. We do also have another comment from our listener, Susan, who says, please discuss the effects of marijuana that is eaten rather than smoked. Bertha Madras, did you want to take that?
Well, I will take that. The edible literature is very new, obviously, because the whole industry has just geared up with making the drug more palatable in terms of adding sugar and sweeteners and flavors to enhance the product, the market. But what is known is that the great hazards that we have seen where it's legal, such as in Colorado, and essentially it's de facto legal in California now, the use of edibles can lead to greater psychotic states because people simply don't stop eating an eighth of a brownie when the package says you should eat an eighth of a brownie. So they are accumulating massive doses of THC, which they don't get within the first few hours because it takes a few hours for it to clear the gut, get through the liver and into the brain. So they keep on eating, thinking that, well, they don't feel much, so they can ignore the package warnings. And then they get full-blown psychosis from a very, very high doses. So I think the edibles is not, it may be safer in terms of lung problems, pulmonary problems, but I think, and again, it focuses on the brain. Marijuana is a highly hazard substance for the brain. That is the focus of what we should be talking about.
Larry Bedard, what about concerns, too, that children are more likely to accidentally ingest marijuana because of the fact that it can be taken in an edible form that way, in like a brownie or a cookie or something like that?
Well, I think parents should be concerned how edible cannabis or cannabis in general is packaged. I know in Colorado, kids do get into edibles and end up in emergency departments. Occasionally, they get admitted.
And
I think that's one of the things that AUMA does.
And again, the Adult Use of Marijuana Act, which is the name of Proposition 64.
Yeah, Proposition 64 is much stricter in how it's regulated than in Colorado. You're not going to have gummy bears. You're not going to have lollipops. That's all illegal under Proposition 64. You're not going to have brownies with 500 milligrams of THC under Proposition 64. They're going to specify the dosage, and people will know the purity as well as the potency. So I think AUMA, or Proposition 64, is designed to address many of the concerns and issues around children and around inadvertent use of children.
Well, let's talk about potency because a listener comments, the potency of marijuana increased substantially between 1975 and 1995. The simple herb that promoted the desire to snack and laugh at stupid comments became a drug that caused the heart to race and extreme anxiety. Paul Armentano, can I get you to comment on that, the increased potency of marijuana over the years, cannabis?
Sure. There has been some increase in overall potency of marijuana. Potency, I don't think, is necessarily the only issue we need to talk about. Certainly, if we use alcohol as a parallel, we have alcohol that is sold in all sorts of different potencies. And what we see with that example is that the majority of the public that consumes alcohol gravitates to alcohol that contains moderate to low potency. We don't see many people that consume alcohol or the majority of people consuming liquor or grain alcohol. And I think we're going to see a very similar trend emerge with cannabis. While there may be some highly potent, more concentrated forms of cannabis on the market, I don't think ultimately that form of cannabis is going to appeal to the general market, particularly in an environment where marijuana is regulated. There is some data indicating that in prohibited markets, when the consumer does not know if they're going to have access to marijuana again anytime soon, in those situations, they tend to gravitate toward higher potency forms of marijuana, but in markets where cannabis is more readily accessible, they don't.
Larry Bedard, how well is what is in marijuana regulated at this point? You know, there have been talk that some people try to make it heavier by adding elements to it that are very harmful.
Well, and they actually did a study where they compared what was advertised on a packet of an edible in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle, Washington. Only 17% were accurately labeled. Majority actually had less than what the brownie claimed to have, but there was a significant percentage that had more. All this really, to me, says that's why we need to legally regulate and control the potency and the purity.
Well, let's go to Sapanchu in San Jose. Am I saying your name correctly?
Yeah, that's right. So I have a concern in the form of a question. How quickly and with how much accuracy can amount of marijuana in a person's body be detected? Because DUI, driving under alcohol influence, is itself a big problem right now. And if people are driving cars and vehicles after consuming marijuana, how are cops going to react to it? How are we going to support them technically to be able to detect this?
Stanton Glantz, can you talk a little bit about studies that about the relationship between marijuana and driving and in terms of what effects it has and how that can affect road safety?
Well, it's pretty well established that if you're driving while you're high, that makes you a more dangerous driver. The problem, which is alluded to by the caller, is that there's no good test for sobriety for marijuana the way there is alcohol. There's no breathalyzer equivalent. And when you take marijuana into your body, it actually hangs around for quite a long time. Often at levels below those which are causing, the immediate impairment. And so, if you talk to the police or the National Institutes of Health, which has been thinking about this, it's like if somebody gets pulled over for erratic driving, if they used marijuana, a while ago, that will still show up. And so the pro-marijuana people are saying, like, people could get arrested when they're not actually impaired. And the police are saying, well, we don't have a good way to measure it. So that is a very serious problem. But I'd like to just get back a minute to the issue around edibles, because I think that's a really, really crucial problem, because as experts on the call said, they're so new that we actually don't know a huge amount about them. We do know that the tobacco industry tries to use things like edibles as a way to get kids addicted to nicotine and into using cigarettes, which are more profitable. But the other really big problem is that Prop 64, which is 60 or 65 pages long, writes this 10 milligram per dose standard into law. And it does not really have an easy mechanism for integrating new information as it becomes available. For example, in Colorado, they also created a 10 milligram standard. In Oregon, the health department brought a group of experts together and looked at the evidence which had accumulated in the intervening couple of years, and they set a 5-milligram standard. And if there's one thing I've learned in working in areas around air pollution, which I also do some work with for the state of California, the levels that are considered toxic in terms of air pollutants keep dropping. And, you know, the regulatory scheme, which is locked into 64, is going to make it very hard to adapt things as new information becomes available.
And again, Stanton Glantz is professor of medicine in the Division of Cardiology at UCSF. We're also talking with Bertha Madras, professor of psychobiology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, Larry Bedard, and a retired emergency physician, and he's also on Marin's Healthcare District Board, and Paul Armentano, deputy director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Let's now talk with Ruth in Brisbane. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Hi. I am a 52-year-old woman who had back surgery 2.5 years ago. It left me paralyzed from the waist down with a disease in my back. The doctor did it. He injured me. And if he had had his druthers and the medical community had had their druthers, I would have been addicted to opiates for the rest of my life because that was the only pain medication option. The disease that they left in my body has no cure. There's no medication for it. And that was my option. So I decided that as a parent of two small children, I was not going to be a drug addict. And I was going to live through the pain during the day, and then at night I was going to use medical marijuana. Now, the dilemma with using medical marijuana is that exactly what you're talking about with these edibles is that the edibles are not consistent. And to use these drugs, it means that you're using drugs that are inconsistently the dosages are inconsistent, and so as a patient, you're taking what some days is 10 milligrams, and some days is 40, and some days is 20, and, you know, it's not a healthy way to go about it.
Question, Ruth, along those lines. So given your experience using medical marijuana, and clearly it's been effective in temporarily, you know, alleviating symptoms that you have, which I'm sorry to hear that you have had to go through, but also your experience of inconsistency, do you think that the safety of recreational marijuana is okay? Is that a level where you would feel like it could be legalized and managed?
Oh, yeah. I think that the safety is fine. And I was in Colorado a week and a half ago, and I must tell you that it was such a relief to be able to walk into a store and buy what I needed and not have to freak out. I was in Hawaii 3 weeks ago, and it was much more cumbersome to have to figure out a way to smuggle my medication into Hawaii.
Thank you.
Which is a much more difficult thing to have to figure out.
Well, Ruth, really appreciate the call. John writes, the discussion is about marijuana and THC and smoking. Can the guests comment on the use of cannabinoids like CBD, the non-psychotropic extract of marijuana? Bertha Madras?
Yes. Cannabidiol is a very interesting substance. It has effects that are quite opposite to that of THC, which is the psychoactive constituent of marijuana. In fact, it doesn't produce a high. It is not addictive. It does not produce psychosis. It reduces anxiety, and it has anti-seizure activity and may have other very prominent effects, including neuroprotective effects. The most interesting thing about cannabidiol is that even though it has such powerful positive potential medical uses, it's been bred out of medical marijuana because it reduces the high. And that's one of the big problems in a market such as in California or in other places. The natural plant has a balance between the two, but it has been bred out because people want to be more intoxicated with marijuana. So cannabidiol has therapeutic potential. It's been studied in rare cases of childhood seizure disorders, including Dravet's, and from my perspective, cannabidiol should not be in Schedule 1 as if it passes through the full FDA approval process as an anti-seizure compound, which there is some promising data that this could happen in the next year.
All right. Well, Nicole tweets, I find it ironic that those against legalization are more paranoid than those using cannabis. I work in tech, and cannabis is extremely popular with tech workers. These are some of the most intelligent and creatively problem-solving people in America and experience none of the negative effects your experts are pushing. Just as with alcohol, people have to find their dose, and the claims of psychosis due to smoking or edible use is hysterical nonsense. Martin in San Francisco. Hi, Martin.
How amazing that in the last 5 minutes we touch on the fact that this is something that's going to help gazillions of people get off of pharma drugs, the CBD aspect of it, and that it, they have not been bred out. They are available. So part of that legalizing is to make that available to people. My last point was, please realize long-term longitudinal studies in Jamaica, a culture already imbued with the use of this. Nobody's dying. Nobody's hurt. And in fact, health improved. Please don't condemn entire nations and don't condemn the brilliant people like Carl Sagan and Steve Jobs of the world and the health benefits. Please, this show has come off as a real embarrassment to San Francisco. That's so much negative airtime against cannabis.
Well, Martin,
please look at reality and embrace what's actually happening.
Well, thanks. Glad we got you on. Paul Armentano, did you want to comment? Was that you?
Sure. I would certainly like to comment. I know we're winding down on time. The reality is that Californians, just like adults all around this country, are already using marijuana now. According to the federal government, about 12 or 13% of those over the age of 21 are using marijuana in this country. And it is about time our laws and regulations reflect that reality, not deny it. I'm not here to say that marijuana is innocuous or that it can't in some instances be misused and it doesn't possess or that it doesn't possess some potential risks. But the best way to mitigate those risks is through regulation, the imposition of age restrictions, taxation, and public education, not by criminalization and not by exaggeration. Well, that's why groups like the California Medical Association and the California Nurses Association, pro-public health organizations, endorse Proposition 64, and that's why the majority of Californians will as well.
And Paul Armentano, Deputy Director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. We were also joined by Larry Bedard, a retired emergency physician on the Marin Healthcare District Board, Bertha Madras from Harvard Medical School, and also Stanton Glantz from UCSF. Thanks to all of you for joining us this morning. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Maxine Schofer-Wolf and Brandon Yu, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Thanks to our listeners for all your questions and comments. I'm Mina Kim. Thank you for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.